Welcome to The Method, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of executive leadership. Tune in as we unlock the secrets to success, one coaching session at a time.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. My name is Faith. I am a CEO coach here at Mashari Method. And today I am seriously so thrilled to introduce you to David Sullivan, the man, the myth, the legend, someone who, in my opinion, is the definition of a powerhouse CEO. He's also a father of four, an adventure enthusiast, a client, and a friend who I admire greatly.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're so welcome. Deep respect, my friend.
Respect.
Yes. In particular, the reason I thought it would be nice to do a podcast together is because I really want you to hear his entrepreneurial journey with Flexible Rent or Till, and to get a glimpse into his leadership mindset in particular, because it's unique and it's powerful and it's potent. And I've seen some of what David has accomplished, and I think it's really great to get it out there. We also want to dip our toes into a recent conversation we've been having about the evolution of founders and CEOs. So David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited for our conversation.
Yes.
I've been a big fan of you. So for everyone, Faith has become a good friend. I'm a big fan of Matt and the team that he's building, and just like the process that y'all coach through. Before we work together, I think I've read every single piece written in that Google Doc. Yeah. So I just thank you for all the value you've helped bring to me and our teams.
Yeah.
And I'm just like a big fan of coaching. It's become a really powerful component of how I operate and how I like operate our teams now too. So
yeah. Amen to that. Yeah, you're welcome. I'm excited to see how you evolve as a coach as well now, paying it forward, right? So I'd love to dive in if you're game.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. So would you kick us off just by giving us kind of a high level overview of your journey as entrepreneur, founder, CEO? Take it away.
Sure. Yeah. So the quick story, I've always been interested in building companies. My dad is an entrepreneur. I watched him go through it and always just like had that curiosity. So I went to school and got a finance and accounting background. And I think I left school as the only unemployed graduate in our class. And I just knew I wanted to do something different. But I had like literally no idea what. And so I fortunately found my way to a couple serial entrepreneurs at the time when they were starting a rental housing company. So this was in 2011. And so I joined them as they were forming this entity, and kind of like with a group of 10 of us on this like founding team, having no idea what was going on or what to do. I just jumped into it. And when I was all in, just like, I loved every minute of it. I was doing a bunch of different jobs, kind of like whatever was needed next. And that company was called The American Home. So we built a company from scratch to about $30 million in revenue. And through that multi-year journey, I evolved from do everything guy to help acquire assets and invest and underwrite on a team and build out that team and that function. And I started learning that I really liked building out teams, like understand a problem statement, build from zero to one, install a foundation that can be repeated. That just like is something I love doing. And so I evolved from like everyone's bootstrapping and like doing everything into the COO of that company, ultimately until our exit. And I was just like, my mind was blown that you could do that. And so it was just like swimming in the ultimate deep end for me for about 5 years, got to see from start to finish. I was incredibly burned out. I was leading in retrospect in a terrible way. I could have done so much better, but we still did great as a company and we got a lot of things right. And it was an amazing like learning curve for me. So that then led into being an EIR at a venture fund, Route 66 Ventures, who have been just amazing supporters. They were behind The American Home. I've been with that group and around that group for a long time, deep mentors there. So I got to go work there and study the fintech landscape as they were investing in the fintech market. I spent some time as an entrepreneur in residence, knowing I wanted to like operate again. I wanted to be back in an early stage team building from scratch. And I ended up spinning out of Route 66 and founding a company called Till. And what we were doing is we innovated financial solutions for the rental housing market with a thesis. Like, the broad thesis is, can you improve a renter, the consumer's outcome, in a renter-centric way so that they do better, they access their rental home better, they live more with more stability in the rental home? And if you did right by the end renter and consumer, which kind of sounds obvious, but it just doesn't happen in rental housing all that much. If you do right by the end renter, actually you can like make the landlord more money too. Rental housing is a really unique space where like there's a massive win-win opportunity. Like, if the renter is more stable in the home and they stay in the home longer, then the landlord actually has less turnover cost and they make more money. And so we started innovating products. At the end of the day, we innovated a flexible rent product, which allows a renter to take rent, their biggest expense. It's usually like 40% of their income. We break it down into smaller payments and we align it to their cash flow. So landlords get paid on time, they increase on-time payments, they increase rental payment stability. But for the consumer, they get to, they actually get to like take more control over their largest expense. And the downstream benefits to the consumer are insane. Like, renters are literally like, thank you. Like, I have been struggling to figure out how to budget. This allows me to buy groceries for my children in the first half of the month. It's like, oh my God, there's like a really profound impact that you can have on the consumer by doing this. And then the next thing we did is we started reporting rent. So we're a data furnisher. We report successful rental payments up to the credit bureaus just as a free feature as part of using flexible rent, so that the consumer builds their credit score. So rent is an underreported trade line. Like, the majority of renters, it's about a third of our country, don't have their rent trade line reported to the credit bureau, and thus they don't build their credit score, which is mind-boggling because it's their biggest expense. Rent is effectively a 12-month $1,000 to $2,000 installment loan, but we don't treat it as like a country or as an industry as such yet. That is changing. That momentum's changing, which is good, but we're still like at the very early days of it. So we founded Till with that premise. I thought, oh, I've run a company before. And it was like, oh shit, no. Actually running like a tech startup and building it from scratch and raising venture to support it and grow it. And like, there's a credit component behind our product. So we're starting like a credit program, which has a balance sheet component, was a very different thing than running the American home. So like, had to go through a lot of the humility learning curves that it takes just to like put those pieces in place correctly. And we got some of them right. We got some of them horribly wrong. I hedged a lot in the early days, which was absolutely incorrect, and led to maybe some of the learnings we're going to talk about today. But it was an amazing experience building Till. And then last year we sold Till to Best Egg, where we now run Best Egg Flexible Rent as part of the Best Egg ecosystem. So a little bit about Best Egg. Best Egg is a consumer fintech, just like LendingClub or SoFi. We focus on serving customers with limited savings, and our mission is to help them evolve on their financial journey. So we have a suite of tools. We have a financial health platform that helps people monitor their credit score and budget. We have a personal debt consolidation loan that helps renters really, or consumers, take control of their debt or refi out of really bad or expensive debt. We have a credit card that helps a consumer access a credit card and then begin building their financial profile and evolve from there. And we have a vehicle equity product. So flexible rent was a perfect fit. Flexibility is a core theme. We want to help consumers take flexible control of different aspects of their financial life. And joining and selling to Best Egg has been a whole nother evolution on my entrepreneurial journey. It's joining and moving our team over into a new company. We had very similar mission, very similar vision statements for the consumer, which was really cool. Very strong alignment. So that's worked really well. I'm really proud. We've retained everyone except for one person in the transition. It's been 1 year now this week, which is pretty incredible. And our thesis for moving into this org, which was to access more resources so we could grow more quickly out in the market, has paid off, and that's working right now. So another learning curve for me in joining, selling, and merging our company, a tech company, into another tech company, and finding those synergies.
Yeah, thank you. And like, as people who are listening, you know, you can only imagine the bumps in the road that must have come in part of this process, right? Because David did a good job of, you know, humbly sharing the successes. And then we also all know as entrepreneurs how many gray hairs we get in the journey, you know? I think one of the things I'd love for you to share on is just kind of the language you and I were using was how we embraced the suck, right? And took the lesson away from the hardest moments of that process. Would you be game to kind of talk a little bit about how you did that, sort of the mentality you sort of emerged with on the other side?
Yeah, for sure. So let's just talk about like the hardest moment.
Yeah.
And so about 2 years ago, we were fundraising, like companies growing, teams evolving. We have two products with some features in market. We're fundraising. We had a $15 million financing round that was done except for cash being wired into the bank. 8 months running a process, found a lead, 4 months with the lead, finished business company diligence, finished legal diligence, had final legal docs, sent legal docs out for investor signatures, thinking we're funding that financing round the next week. And I got a call from the partner that weekend. It was like, hey, there's some instability here. We are probably freezing our fund for 6 months. We're taking a vote on Monday morning, whether we're freezing our fund, and we're taking a vote that if we freeze our fund, whether we're proceeding with this investment. And I was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
So it's like, go into hyperdrive. What can I do to make this happen? And long story short, they pulled the deal like at the very last minute. And I knew I was racing against the clock because during this fundraise, like the fintech venture market started really failing. Like some of the public companies out there, like Upstart, like their valuations had started falling and ended up falling like 90%. And so it was like, I knew that was happening. And like, what was hard is like our business model needed a major capital injection at the exact same time, like the capital markets started failing. And so it would have been easy just to been like, that's the game. But in embracing the suck, like I had like no idea what to do and my mind was racing. And time mattered. Like we had to make very quick decisions. And so I was like going on 3 to 4 hour walks at like 3 a.m. just to like try to calm my mind and figure out what moves you're going to make. And in the course of the week, what I realized is I was failing. The reason we were at that point is because as a startup in the time when times were good for all of us as startups, I wasn't actually operating effectively as a leader. Like my leadership team actually wasn't coalesced. I was playing the game with fear instead of love. And what I mean by that is like, I was hedging. Like I was fearful that maybe one strategy wouldn't play out the way I thought it would. And I was hedging by adding different features. I was hedging by trying to like make all different sales and like distribution channels work. And what was really powerful about that moment is it was like, it was a design constraint. It was like, you only have enough capital to bet on one outcome. What's the bet? And so in the course of that week, when that capital raise pulled, some of our investors offered to put money in. But the problem was I was hedging and betting on two different product and features, two different go-to-market channels, different leadership. I was even hedging in leadership, like different leadership taking on different responsibilities. And that was like my kind of enlightenment moment, as much as it sucked, and it fucking sucked. We ended up having to riff 40% of the company. We shut down a product line. we shut down our main go-to-market line, and we decided to sell in 5 days.
Ugh.
And I was working like 20 hours a day making those decisions. But the real thing was, wait a minute. No, like I'm hedging. I'm playing with fear. And it just so happened at the time I was like trying to read a lot too and trying to like help find like where do I go? Where is the North Star?
Yes.
And I was spending a lot of time with Pat, like going back to Patrick Lencioni's work and studying like what's going on there. And it just like hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, one, I have to make every decision I possibly can to create clarity. And I can't hedge. So where are the like deep bets I have to make today? Where am I making bets? Where like fear and anxiety are like really good signals. It's like, where do I have fear and anxiety? And that's what I need to create the clarity around. And like the embracing the suck means actually acknowledging what's the biggest problem statement that has fear and anxiety. Why do you have it there? And what is the one action you're going to take to eliminate that thing? And then you have to like get past that moment as fast as you can to then find the next one. And so I just started ruthlessly working through that framework. And what I got to was with Lencioni's like advantage, kind of a modified version of that framework, which maybe we can talk about later. But like, it basically comes down to like, do you have a leadership team? And that was a rude embrace the suck awakening for me. It was like, no. It's like, dang it. I've been working on this for like 3 years and my gut answer is no, but I have these like amazing leaders. But it was like, no, I as a leader failed. Like I didn't coalesce those amazing leaders into a leadership team, a team that actually puts like the team and the company above their functions. Yeah, I have an amazing CTO and I have a great head of product and I have a great sales leader, but like that doesn't mean you have a leadership team. And so like, that was a humbling experience. Like, no, we must form as a team. And then it was like, do we actually all agree on the most important thing? And it was like, shit, no, there's discord. And so it was like, okay, well, it's actually very simple. I was failing as a leader across like three simple things. I didn't have a leadership team. So that was like priority one. As soon as I like started making some like clear decisions is like, make that team a team. Priority two then just became like, we have to go create clarity as a group. So I went to that group and was like, here's the vision. We're betting on this distribution channel. This is what we're going to do with our product. This is like what we're shutting down. But you all have to buy in and commit to that. So we had some really hard debates. We were working around the clock, like 9 p.m. meetings type things, board meetings at like midnight, because time mattered. And after like a week, we started coalescing and we started making some key one-way decisions and bets all the way to the point where it's like, we have to sell the company. In that same week, it was like, no, I'm not taking that capital. We're selling the company because now that we have clarity on the distribution channel and clarity on the product value proposition and commitment from the leadership team towards this path, the best way for this product to scale for users is to actually put it on a, like a massive fintech platform. I can't raise enough capital to get to like feature parity as those groups. If I just put it there, then we're going to go do that. But it was like create the leadership team, coalesce and create clarity around some of the key things, and then start working on actually establishing trust with that group, more trust and more clarity of commitment towards where we're going to go after that like crisis moment. So. Yeah. But it was literally one of those things where it was like, okay, there's like 30 hard things to do today. I'm just going to, now that I have a mental model with like leadership team and create clarity for our team and the rest of the org and commit to it, I'm just going to put all 30 things in a list of what I want to do least to what I'm okay doing most, from worst to best, basically. And I just drew like a one with permanent marker on my arm. It was like, I'm going to do one thing at a time. I'm just going to do the hardest thing first. And I would just wake up and do that one thing and do that one thing. And now, fast forward like 2 years, we have super high degrees of trust. We have really good challenge and accountability within our leadership team. The entire org is focused and we're growing faster than we've ever grown hands down. And it's really fun. So there was another side of it. And like, I think that capital raise pulling is hands down the best thing that's ever happened to me as a professional leader. Because it forced me to reconcile hard truths that like I might not otherwise have reconciled. We had an offer to buy the company a year before that. And had we sold at that time, I would not have gone through this like evolution and like enlightenment to as to like what it takes to actually get a high performing team to deliver results in a really like strong way.
The earlier stage startup, not having enough capital, right? Too many things to do, too little time, too few people. But thank you for just diving into that. Because I think I remember in the early days of us working together, you talked a lot about like driving clarity being your number one priority with your team. And it was a real treat for me on the outside looking into your world to kind of hear how you got there. Because what you said toward the end, there's a couple of things I'd love to underline. There's, you talked about trust, right? And building trust with your team. And everything you've talked about in terms of like driving clarity, right? Making sure you've got that kind of first team mentality where everybody's really working in sync with each other. There's no silos. That helps build trust, right? And then how you show up as a leader, one of the things you didn't mention is outside looking in, David seems to be incredibly responsive. His response time is insane, like of how quickly he'll get back to people, because you've said in your own words, like, my number one job is just to make sure people are unblocked, you know, as CEO. The other thing that you said that I thought was really interesting was how you dealt with that pressure, right? Of there are 30 mission critical things for us to do. I'm going to tackle it one at a time, because this is one of the most common things I coach on across the board, is just how to handle it when you have too much to do and too little time, and really trying to drive into what is it that only you as CEO can do,
yeah,
that would have the greatest impact. You know, so I don't know if that inspires anyone who's listening to go grab a Sharpie and draw one on your arm. I'm a big fan of that. So, but like, it's a great approach. Is there any like pointer or hard earned like nugget of clarity you got from that process of really how you still will choose what is the thing that I must do above all else, besides it being the hardest thing, like eat that frog?
Well, I think like one thing I found is like the create clarity or unblock. It starts with all the way up to like the first question in the Lencioni framework is like, why do you exist? Like, what's your mission statement? Do you actually agree?
Mm-hmm.
That unblocks people to be like, oh yeah, I'm committed to like this org. But then it's like, even once you start defining even lower down, it still exists. It's like, wait. No, what did we actually mean by this like product roadmap feature?
Mm-hmm.
And like, there will be disconnected ambiguity between like even two founders on that one item. Like, we're actually terrible at communicating. Humans, just generally, we're like terrible at communicating and eliminating ambiguity. And we had this like in like this moment on our leadership team where we're sitting there, and this came from our CTO, and he's like, ambiguity is everywhere. I want to fucking destroy the ambiguity. Like, I can't make enough progress and ambiguity is in my way. And that was my unblock, was like, oh my God, you are right. Our job, the create clarity side of it, is literally everywhere. That's the unblock, all the way from like, no, don't work on this. That's clarity. Yes, do work on this. Oh, you don't have enough resources? Here's a resource. Oh, this person is trying to have you work on this thing. No, that's a distraction. Just say no. You have the permission to say no. That's another like ability to create clarity in that focus.
Yeah.
And so when like a CEO or leader is prioritizing, like the way I prioritize is I just have a list of all of the major projects that I think like our leadership team needs to be working on. We review that as a group. It's a bottoms up. Everyone every Monday says, here's the top three things I'm working on as a team. And I'm just taking inventory of like, is this driving at what we just agreed to from a clarity standpoint? If not, where do I need to go so that the leadership team is like spending their time in the most high leverage way? So it starts with like, do we have the organization aligned? If not, that's where I spend my time. Once the organization's aligned, on thematic goals or mission. Then it's like, are leaders, like, they're the highest leverage investment we can make. Are they unblocked? And then once they're unblocked, then I'm looking at what are the like one or two projects that I can lean into and more like actively drive urgency or focus or like movement on that I want to. Like, I'm a builder. And this gets to kind of like later in the conversation. Like, I like having a pet project because I like building stuff. But like, the house has to be in order first. Like, I have to have like strategic alignment of the business, leadership unblocked and focused in the right areas. And then like, I'll take on a high leverage project that's unique to me. And then when you look across those themes, it's just like, for the week, what are the top couple of things that have to happen? And that becomes a priority list. And then it just starts like, then it's easy. Then you just execute.
Love it. Some of this is so straightforward, right? Like, and yet it's so easy to get wrong as a leader when you have 10,000 things coming at you from every angle and it never stops. And you're putting in those hours of the early days startups, right? Where you're doing 60, 70, 80 hour work weeks, like verging on burnout, right? Trying to keep it all going. And so in particular, the simplicity of how you approach things with just the number one mission of driving clarity at all costs, right? And really empowering your leadership team to get the results you need them to get. I think it can be so powerful.
I kind of felt like dumb. I'm like,
right?
You have an ego. It's like, I did a company and we sold. It's like, and you're like, I'm going to do another company. And then it's like, things get hard. And it's like, Like, if it's just a mental model, it's just like, do we have a leadership team with trust and have we created clarity?
Yeah.
And if you just have that as your two-step mental model,
yeah.
I started looking at my world. I'm like, I have been failing as a leader for like over a decade. Why has it taken, I'm like, feel dumb. Like, why has it taken me so long to figure out that like, if you just apply that two-step framework, everything gets better and more fun.
It's so real. And I hope anybody who's out there who's a listener and who's a leader, whether you're a CEO, a founder, like a C-suite exec, or just a leader in general, like, I hope you're laughing with us. I'm laughing because like, I failed spectacularly. Like, I think some people choose leadership and some people have leadership like thrust upon them. I was kind of like in the latter category, you know, like with the startup I helped build. And I can't tell you how many mistakes I've made. Like, you were talking about reading all the books, trying to figure it out. I think I read like 50 and then I stopped counting. So I was like, what? How are we going to do this? And It's so simple and yet so complex. The thing I want to highlight, though, too, that you haven't mentioned that I think is important to mention in this context that I think contributed, again, outside looking in, you tell me if I'm wrong. But I think you did an impeccable job with hiring, right? Yes, there probably were bumps along the way, but I think one of the things that stands out to me looking in is the culture of fit that you nailed with like the values of your company and how much you guys embody those values. I bring this up because this is one of those things that I'm passionate about as a coach because it's a soft skill to most people. And most people, I think, devalue or underestimate how powerful values can be when you really, really live and breathe them and you hire by them and you therefore are getting great cultural fits. You're quick to let people go who are not. And that's ultimately a massive driver of your success.
That is true. I spend a like inordinate amount of time on recruiting strategy.
See?
Yes, we recruited good talent. Mm-hmm. I did not put them into a leadership team and we did not act as a leadership team. Mm-hmm. And now it's to the point where like our head of engineering on yesterday's call was like holding me accountable for something, cultural something. I was like, oh my God, yes, this is amazing.
Yeah.
But I love building and installing and like have the like deal junkie nature and recruiting mm-hmm. is like such a great place. It's like, you get to go into the world and find people that align to your values. And like the one thing we've always said is like, we're not looking to convince anyone that what we're doing is important. We're looking to find people that already believe in what we're doing and like that already ascribe to the mission. Mm-hmm. So it's super easy. Once you find those people and the skill set alignment's there
yeah.
and you like we have a pretty like standard process now for how we screen, with some like who methodology in there. It's like once you have that motion and you can just consistently, that system can consistently bring really good bought-in talent into the organization.
Yeah. Amen to that. And I think for people who are listening who are in the earlier stages, right, where you can, you haven't quite hit your stride there yet, your hiring process still feels clunky, that's normal, right? This is part of the process of really figuring out what the heartbeat is of your organization and really who you all are, how you operate best, and how to really refine that hiring process. Same thing for training. And I think, David, one of the things that you plan to mention too is also how you take the bottoms up approach with your leaders. Just kind of, could you share just a little bit about that too? Because I think that's a really key piece as well for how you built this powerful leadership team.
I don't think you can mention the bottoms up without mentioning like just like how the system operates.
Yeah.
Because it's dependent on the framework. So here's the like 2 minute flyby overview. Like, so Patrick Lencioni's Advantage playbook basically just says like, you have to create a leadership team, you have to create clarity, and you have to communicate clarity. And then he has a couple questions in the create clarity category. So at first, we just literally copied that and we've evolved it a little bit. So credit where credit's due. Step one, I think fundamentally, like the CEO must be bought in. The ultimate leader, or if you're doing this within your team, you have to drive the change. Otherwise, the change doesn't happen. Step two, like you have to form the leadership team. We've hit on that enough, but it has to be small, like 3 to 6 people, maybe up to 9, but the fewer the better. And it's truly like who is ride or die going to make your organization great that you need to lean on. Step three, you just create the clarity. Starts with why do you exist, mission, how do you act, values, what do you do, what are you selling? How do you win your differentiators? Who's on the team? When do you meet? What's your meeting cadence? What's your process for getting together and communicating? What's your ceremonies? What functions must exist? These sound like very basic things, and these things don't change that much. So you go through that, and you can define it as a leadership team in like a day or 2 days. It's pretty involved dialogue, but like, you can answer those questions pretty quickly. Once you have those questions and you agree, all right, here's the functions. Great. Here's the leaders. Okay, great. You'll be surprised at how often there's disagreement among that in teams. I've informally coached 2 friends, and I went to one and we were like, the 3 founders were like, what are these answers? And I had them do it all separately. And then we came together and there was like 50% misalignment across like the most basic things. So you just go through those basic things in order. And then you agree on like what's most important right now. What's your thematic goal? Like it basically needs to be your rallying cry, like charge this mountain. And then there's like a couple objectives that need to support that. And they're all qualitative. So like ours is we need to serve flexible rent as an embedded fintech solution through property management system partnerships. That's our rallying cry. And then there's a couple objectives. You know, we needed to join Best Egg. We needed to like relaunch our program through a new bank partner. And we need to launch our first 3 partnerships. And we did that this year. So it's like 3 very specific, like that's what we're gonna go do. And then the way you get bottoms up is like, now you as a leadership team have committed to this list of things, but you actually haven't said what you're gonna go do to make that happen. So that's where the bottoms up comes in. You're not actually telling anyone what to do. You just told them what matters. And so then the ask is like, all right, leaders, go into your functions, make sure your charters are right within the functions so that you know function A is doing this and function B is doing this. There's not gaps and there's not incorrect overlap. And just say, what are the things y'all are going to go do? What are you going to measure to make sure that we achieve these goals? And so the leaders go work with their teams, can be as quick as like a week. And you build roadmaps. And so it's a bottoms up buy-in on where you're going because the leaders have been in that meeting and have committed to where you're going. They then go work with their teams to get bought into what they're actually going to go produce to achieve those results. And there's debate, right? They'll come bring those items forward and the leadership team will debate. I will debate and challenge. And there's also a certain level of trust. Like, you think that's going to move the needle the most? Great. Like, go prove that. And so you commit, but you have to have the trust, right? So you committed top down. You put trust in place. You challenge each other. Then you can hold each other accountable. And it just gets to the trust pyramid. But that's where the bottoms up comes in. And then for us as a leader, like, in this process, what you're actually doing is you're narrowing focus, which then allows you to drive accountability and urgency. And so we then have a weekly meeting where all the projects everyone said they were going to do, everyone has to come status light them beforehand and throw a couple notes in. And we only look at yellow and red status lights, like slightly off track or materially off track. And then we just understand, like, what do we have to do to get those things on board? And that holds the whole system accountable. So they've said that's what they're going to do, which means they think that's the best next step. You're not forcing that step on them. And then they're accountable for doing that step. And that's the framework.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. As you all can tell, I'm biased and I'm a big fan. There's a lot of overlap here, just to call it out for anybody who's new to the Mashari method. The document that David mentioned at the beginning is called, we call it our curriculum. And it's basically like an encyclopedia of best practices that have been gleaned from the most successful orgs out there. And so a few of the things, if you want to look into them, we have a couple of write-ups in there that would be that directly apply to what David's talking about and go into more detail. One of them is called decision-making. We'll include the link to the curriculum in the description of the podcast. And then we'll also, if you want to just go to MasharIMethod.com, you can go to the blog and the curriculum is there as well. So one write-up is decision-making. The other one is OKRs. Now, what I want to point out about what David just shared is underline this. What you did as CEO is you told them what mattered. You focused on the what. You got really effing clear on that, right? And then you asked your team to come through on the how, right? And you did that in a way that was not decision by committee, because I think that's where most people get scared when you're working with leadership teams and as you're starting to delegate more and more of what you do and letting your people show up for you. It is not decision by committee. And if you do look at that decision-making document, specifically what David's talking about here is taking like a method two or method three approach for this process of generating buy-in, right? And having these critical conversations with the team in such a way that everybody's voice is heard, but it's very clear who the decision-maker is going to be, right? And that's the piece that I also see people struggle with sometimes. Whether you use RACI or RAPID or MOCA or DARCY, whatever you use, in my mind, that's one of the most critical things you can do. And David, what you also mentioned earlier too, is like how much ambiguity can really screw with people. Yeah. And so when you use a decision-making framework, right, of who is owning this, right? Who is the decision maker? Who's like managing this? Who are we consulting? Who's going to help? Who's the approver? That kind of thing. You're helping just eradicate ambiguity. And you're also helping your team just hold each other accountable. Like you mentioned, right? Your CTO, CFO was holding you accountable to something you needed to do. And like, that's the money, right?
Well, you mentioned something that's really important is like the CEO is always default decision maker. But you can delegate the decision making. You can say, okay, Faith, you are now the decision maker on this. If you need my input, call me. Or these are the other people that we need you to like make sure that are on board or at least aware and have input to your decision. But like something I see a lot of people getting wrong is the team lead or the CEO in our this point of this conversation is always default decision maker. So expect it. Be explicitly clear if not. And it doesn't mean like you're top down commanding. We use this very simple, like fist to five commitment measure where it's like, okay, I'm making this decision, but I want to make sure everyone's heard. So like talk about it for 10 minutes, give me your input, and then I'm going to make a call. And so we talk about it and we'll just say like, all right, so no, the mission statement is, you know, this. Let's do a fist of five. And so we do it physically where it's like, on the count of three, what's your commitment level? And zero is like, I hate this. This is the worst idea ever. And five is like, this is the greatest. And everyone votes. And if you're three or below, you get to talk. If you're four or five, like, you're committed enough. So usually we'll have like a three out there for something. And then it's like, all right, tell us why you're a three. Well, I generally like this. I wish the wording was different. I generally like this. I think this assumption is risk is there. It's like, okay, I hear you. Thank you for speaking out loud. I'm still making this decision. Will you verbally commit into the decision? So it's like, no one ever in the future is like, oh, I told you so. It's like, no, that's annoying. And you're not committing or trusting the decision maker. Like, you had your chance. You spoke up. We heard you. We still made the decision. Or we heard you and we rehashed it again. And maybe we got to a better outcome. It could be either. But at the end of the day, everyone's heard. You still have to make a decision. Many decisions, not everyone's like, it's not the decision they would necessarily make. And that's okay, as long as you have a way to make sure people are heard and then they commit into it afterwards. So they're as complicit as anyone else.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that's worth mentioning here is when you think about making people feel heard, and you want, again, we have a write-up for this. It's called Heard, How to Make People Feel It. But when you make people feel heard, the key is closing the loop on the conversation, right? You're repeating back more or less what they said to check for understanding first, right? You validate their experience. Like, oh yeah, that makes so much sense. I could totally see why you would feel like that, right? There's a difference between validating someone's experience and agreeing with it.
Yeah.
Right. And then you can move forward from there. So my decision is this, like, so I heard you, I validated your experience. I'm thanking you for sharing it because your opinion is important to me. You know, that's why you're on this leadership team or on the team in general.
Yeah. Repeating it back is super powerful.
Right.
But it's also like making sure people are heard is an important accountability check on yourself too. Like, it's not just making sure people are heard so that they agree with the decision you're ultimately going to make. Sometimes that's true. But like, I am also an intuitive decision maker. So like, I get to the step I want to take like 80% faster than most people. But like 20% of the time is wrong because I'm an intuitive decision maker. And so having like more judgmental decision makers around me being like, yo, you're being an idiot. Like, you actually should listen to what I'm saying right now because you're going to change your mind has like improved my decision making ability too. But the point is, there's still a decision maker. You make the decision and you commit.
That's beautiful. And the thing that David does really well, that again is one of those like soft things in the room that I don't think you can always catch, is there's a lot of work that goes into creating a psychologically safe environment, right? I'm not talking about like a super woke environment where everybody is dealt with kid gloves. I'm talking about the kind of environment where directness is like always there and people feel safe to say something that goes against what you're saying, to call you on something that they feel goes directly against the mission, right? To say something they think might piss you off. And when you really do the work early on of setting the foundation of psychological safety by building trust, right? Showing people that it's safe to make mistakes, right? Because that's a sign that they're striving, of healthy striving. Like, you make a mistake, great. Flag it. Let's learn from it. We won't repeat it, you know? There's so much gold there. So I know we're getting close on time. We've got like 7.5 minutes left. And so what I would love to do of your game, just briefly, is to dip our toes into that evolution of like leadership.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I think this is a cool place to wrap. So for context, this is something that stood out to me as something that we weirdly don't talk about very much for leaders, right? There's so much that's glorified about being an entrepreneur or a CEO. And there's a lot of pain and strife and struggle alongside the like exhilaration and high and like the great triumphs that you see in leadership. So what I tried to do is I tried to come up with a visual to explain to people how your work as a CEO evolves, and really as a leader in general, when you are part of taking the company from zero to one, right? So I'm going to share my screen. And for those of you watching, I would love for you to just take a look at this image here. Super simple. This is not fancy or sexy. What I tried to do here is to put this on an axis, right? Of you're wearing all the hats, like day one of your vision for this company, right? You started the thing, you're doing all the things pretty much all yourself or with your co-founder, right? So this side is the what you're doing down here. Sorry for the delay. And this is this side, the axis where we're talking about your role's evolution into a true CEO at the end of the day. So the piece that I feel like we weirdly don't talk about that we've kind of touched on a little bit throughout the conversation today is just how your work evolves over time, right? As you start to build in what these orange lines are the formal levels of hierarchy within the org. Even if you have a flattened org, we can have a conversation that's kind of similar around this, about what your role should be for CEO. But as time goes on, and on my mind, what's happening as a CEO is when you're down here at one level, you're doing all the things, right? You're putting on a million and a half hats, and so are your leaders, because that's what's needed, right? You have to be agile. You have to be adaptive and willing to just go wherever you need to go. As time goes on and you get these new levels in, right, your role goes much less generalist to much more specialist, right? Like if you're operations or your marketing or your HR, that kind of thing. But specifically for CEOs, the point that I was trying to make, and then I really want your input on this, David, because I think you shared some really beautiful stuff when we talked about this, is that as a CEO, you're doing less and less and less of the hands-on doing. This is the mistake that I made. I kept trying to hold on to too much as opposed to delegating it to my team, because if I delegated it, then who was I, right? The work had become my identity as a leader, and I needed to help wrap my mind around what it looked like from my different version of work, you know? And so it became much more about, with all the formal levels of hierarchy, much more about me owning the vision, communicating the vision, holding my team accountable, figuring out the what's important, letting them figure out the how. David, take it away.
Well, actually, as you were saying that, I was like, dang, there's probably an entire conversation. I would love to listen to a podcast about like founder and CEO identity and yes, how identity probably more often than it should be is tied to your work and how positive it is for your mental health to disconnect your identity and ego from your work. But it's also what makes it's like one of the superpowers of like founders is they are so passionate. It's like another wall, screw it, going through. But it like incorrectly ties your identity to what you're doing.
So real. I'm going to zoom out for a second, because what David did was when we had this conversation, he took a turn at kind of showing his own version of this. So mine's on the left. This is David's on the right. So I'm going to zoom in so y'all can see it. David. Well,
it was actually interesting. So like for people listening, like when Faith was challenging me on this idea, it hit me. I was like, oh my God, I've always identified as like for this company, I was a founder CEO. And I was like, actually, I think those are different things, but we're all like so proud that we started something from scratch that we keep the founder like check mark, but it's actually like very different roles. I started realizing like, wait a minute, we should actually think of these as like different responsibility sets and delineate a break. Like I am no longer a founder. Like as a founder, my job was to literally do everything. Like if I didn't do something, it was existentially going to fail. Like no one else was going to do that thing. But at a certain point, you earn the like resources to operate with more leverage. And so I think that's like the biggest mental transition for me is like, oh yeah, no, I was a founder. Like I built something where 90% of my time was like, build the thing. Like creating clarity, it's like, yeah, I have a thesis and I have a little bit of money or a starting point. But now it's like, it's not going to happen unless I go do it. So like, I don't really need to create or communicate that much clarity because there's like three of us sitting here. The three of us just need to like build this stuff and see if it works and like prove or disprove certain pieces of the hypothesis. Mm-hmm. But once you actually start like being able to raise, and this is probably where most people, most of my friends in this journey are like get stuck or hung up is like, no. They like, yo, these people just gave you like $5, $10, $20, $50 million to deploy. You're not a founder anymore. Like you are now a CEO. Like you have to then go like the thing you're building is the culture. you're not building the product anymore. And for a while, I was like sad about that. I was like, no. I like started this because I'm really passionate about this customer problem and the product and solution set we have. But it's actually, I was like, wait, no, I'm not working on that anymore. But I actually am working on that. I'm just working on that with high leverage. So now I am a CEO. Now I have enough capital to deploy that it's really, I need to not do more, which is the founder mindset. I need to actually do less. And I need to invest my time in creating a culture, creating that clarity, creating a leadership team, and investing in high leverage outcomes so that the product can actually serve more people. Yes, I'm like sad I'm not actually like building a certain piece of the product, but I actually like, I'm now helping 10 times more people. And so I think that is like the major transformation and realization that I had when we were having this conversation. And it's, you know, everyone's LinkedIn says founder, CEO, but it actually is two different roles. And that realization has been super helpful. And I've had to go through another version of that where now within Best Egg, what's been amazing about being at Best Egg beyond like mission vision alignment is like my resource base went from being still in like a pretty well capitalized startup to like when I showed up, they're like, and here's the legal team and here's the FP&A team and here's the compliance team and here's the capital markets team and here's this team. And I was like, whoa, I need to like rethink my framework again so that I can really try to understand how do I get all these teams aligned. There's a whole nother level of ambiguity and clarity creation needed. But more now it's like, how do I do less so that the investments we make have the high leverage impact opportunities that they truly have and deserve? And that's been like a whole nother like evolution for me. And I've actually found that, I mean, there's certain weeks where you're working 100 hours a week as a founder, and that just is what it is. And there are certain moments, like the hard moment we talked about earlier, selling the company, like time matters, urgency matters, and the work input matters. Like 80 hours a week sustained for like a couple months to make those things happen, you just have to do it. However, that doesn't always have to be true, and it's actually unhealthy for it to be true. So the other thing in this like transition I've realized is like my decision-making and communication, which are the high leverage investments that I make as a leader, get better the more space I make and the less I'm actually doing. So I need to be putting like leadership resources behind me and with me so that the key strategic things are moving forward. But I now am like afforded, and like you as a CEO in a more well-capitalized, less existential space are afforded like the space to think out 6, 12, 24 plus months. But to do that really effectively, you need to do less. You actually just need more time, like meditate, write, walk, call people, riff on an idea, do it again. And so I found like thematically, it's like founder, do more, do everything, do it as fast as you can with urgency. CEO, just create the clarity to narrow your team's focus so they're operating with urgency and high velocity execution. But then once that's there, do less. Just like stop and like give yourself the space to think about the next strategic move, because it's going to be the difference in like massive amounts of value creation if you get it right.
So y'all, you can see why we're a little passionate about this. And David, I think you're right. I think we probably should have another podcast. We could probably get some other people on it too to talk about how your identity is tied to your work. But thank you for just nerding out with me on this front for a bit, because I think it's an important conversation for all of us to be having as leaders out there in the world, right? Because what is a business if not its people? And what is the impact you're having as a business if not on your people first and foremost, whether that's the people you employ, people you serve, you know? And so much of this boils down to how you show up as a leader, you know, and the clarity you have around your own intentions, your own needs for execution, what only you can do to keep the mission moving forward. Yeah. So there's so much more we could say, but we're definitely at time. So David, as always, thank you for being game just to dive in and chat and do our first podcast together.
I love it. Thank you for hosting me. I love talking about this stuff. I've become like super passionate about it. So I appreciate just having a conversation. Hopefully anyone listening gets a little bit of value out of it.
Yeah, I hope so. So listeners, if you have any questions, comments, if you're like, wow, that was a hot take and I fundamentally disagree, I really want to hear about that. So let us know, get in touch. Otherwise, we will be, hopefully we'll do another one soon and possibly dive into more about identity and a lot of stuff we kind of just glazed over today really quickly. So David, you're a rock star. Thank you so much. And let's get to it.
I love it. Thank you.
If you're interested in working with a Mashari Method coach, please DM at @ADAMECOURT on Twitter, or check out MasharIMethod.com, or email us at coach@MasharIMethod.com. Thank you.